The Mad Tech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of ExchangeWire's Mad Tech Podcast. I'm your host this week, Anne-Marie Sheedy, CRO at ExchangeWire, and I'm delighted to be joined by James Florence, Head of Advertising Technology, Immediate Media. Hello, James.
Hi there. Thanks very much for having me.
Absolute pleasure. And also joined by the lovely Matt Broughton, Research Lead at ExchangeWire. Hi, Matt.
Hello, Anne-Marie. Hi, James. Looking forward to the conversation today.
Good. Well, let's crack on then. So the first story is it's from the BBC, and it's about Disney launching ad-supported tier in the UK. So the story outlines how Disney Plus plans to launch an ad-based streaming tier in the UK in November as profits continue to fall flat at the business. Well, not necessarily flat, they're just falling. The new tier will cost around £4.99 per month in the UK. Disney faces a range of issues, poor film performance, and a steep drop in ad sales through its linear TV business. Now, the article says it also plans to crack down on password sharing following similar action taken by Netflix. Overall, revenue at the company grew by 4% year on year in the 3 months ending 1st of July, but it posted a loss of $460 million. That's compared to $1.4 billion profit in the same period last year. There's some hefty numbers. Taking that into consideration, James, I'm going to come to you first. It's a pretty broad question, but hopefully I'll just get the flow of conversation going. Is ad-supported TV the future, do you think?
Well, I think, to be honest, given the levels of investment required to make this stuff for the quality of Netflix and Disney and the other streaming platforms turn out, I think it's got to be. I just don't see how you could sustain that cost base on subscription only and continue to grow the business. And I think that's something that traditional TV vendors, for want of a better word, you know, found out quite a long time ago. And I think, you know, I think it's just essential to maintain that scale.
Okay. So would you say then, is the current streaming market sustainable then?
I mean, I think we're seeing that it's, unless you're a very niche player with a very sticky subscriber base, as competition increases, you know, now there are 7 or 8 streaming services, you know, you just can't, you know, maybe 5 or 10 years ago it was, because there are only 1 or 2 players, most people are willing to pay for both of them. I think when there are 7 or 8, I know from my own experience, you know, it's, you have to start juggling between them. You have to trim those one. Otherwise you're spending £70 or £80 a month on streaming services, which, you know, the current times for most people just isn't something they're willing to do.
Yeah, that's true. And we've talked a lot about kind of subscription fatigue on this podcast over various different discussions. And like you said, in the current climate, we just don't have, everyone's kind of keeping an eye on what their outgoings are. And it's a bit of a luxury. Matt, what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I agree that adding an ad-supported tier is the absolutely right move for Disney. And I think the $4.99 price point is a nice price point for people looking to dip into Disney Plus to watch the occasional film or TV series and then eventually get hooked into it. I do think, though, that raising the price of their subscription tariff at the same time, obviously with cost of living going up, I don't think that's necessarily the right move. Disney obviously has a wealth of content, and obviously since the Star Wars and Marvel acquisitions, it's got even more content, and that's been doing well at the box office, but it hasn't necessarily been performing well in terms of the reviews, which gives it kind of less rewatchability value, which obviously then has a knock-on effect on Disney Plus and its subscription service. And the discoverability on Disney Plus, we have it at home here, and it's not great. You can't flick through like on Netflix and have a nice synopsis of, oh, this is what you can kind of expect from a particular film or TV series. You have to kind of guess it from the poster. So I think there's definitely work they can do to bolster that user experience and actually make it a bit more easy for viewers to discover the, you know, the real depth of content that they have, rather than, oh, I'm looking for a very specific film, I'll watch this, where do they go next?
But what do you think, you know, if we look at it from an ad tech lens and the opportunity that's out there, what are we kind of going down the world of, is it Sky Glass, where the discoverability, it's all in one place? Is that kind of the next step, and that's what we're going to expect from a user experience?
I wouldn't necessarily say it's going to be all in one place, simply because of how fragmented the market is. But I think, obviously, we've had a wealth of new streaming platforms over the last few years. I think there's a lot that they can do to make the experience of using those platforms as easy as possible. Some do it better than others, but I think Disney, it's kind of what they need to improve on. But yeah, I think ad-supported, we're going to see a lot more providers. We've already seen the majority of them launch ad-supported tiers. So I definitely think that the market is recognising the importance of A, lowering the price point for consumers, and B, the profitability that you can get from advertising.
And James, feel free to chip in here if you've got any thoughts. I'm curious to know what you guys think about recent announcements, say, from ITV and their kind of linear revenue falling off a cliff. It's not sustainable because of consumption habits and, where users are going and how they're consuming media. This, I'm interested to know, Matt, you mentioned that $4.99 is a nice price point. For whom? Because who's paying for it? Where's the demographic, do you think, that this leading to? Because if, for me, in, obviously mid-20s/40s, I can afford $4.99. If I'm a student, I could, when I was a student, we'd fight over the TV license and, could we get away with not having one for £14 a month between four or five people in a house. The consumption habits of younger people now, they're just watching content on YouTube. How are they going to appeal, and who are they trying to appeal to at this price point, and what's the kind of content that they need to go to deliver in order to kind of get mass adoption? Any thoughts on that?
I think it's a bit of a tricky one for Disney, perhaps more so than Netflix, because of the massive diversity of content they've got on the platform. $4.99 might be a nice price, but if you're a massive Marvel or Star Wars fan, that, in which case you're getting amazing value there, or, hours and hours and hours of film and TV content. If you don't like those things and actually you're only really interested in kids' cartoons for your little ones, then I think that's a slightly harder sell, because obviously those are available pretty much anywhere.
I don't know. I think my friends would quite happily pay $4.99 to keep their kids occupied, especially during this crap summer that we've had.
That's fair.
Okay, fair enough. I'm going to move on to the next story. This one is from DigiDay, and it's the case for and against MFA. So that's following a feature this week from DigiDay. There's been debates over the state of MFA advertising. To quote, MFAs are not quite criminals, but not exactly angels either. They straddle the line between authenticity and potentially invalid traffic. And well, that leaves just enough wiggle room for marketers to do the mental contortions necessary to swallow this bitter pill. Quite an interesting quote there. On top of that, the ANA, the Association of National Advertisers, recently carried out its first probe into the transparency of the programmatic media supply chain. The report revealed that over a fifth, so that's 21% of ad impressions, are gathered on MFA websites. That's made for advertising websites. And that 15% of the ad spend is currently directed to them. The study also found the average campaign runs across 44,000 websites. Wow, it's kind of scary. Matt, I'm going to come to you first. Is there a case for MFAs?
I really don't see a case for MFAs at all. Yes, the inventory costs are cheap, because if you run a site for next to nothing, load it with ads, including ones that possibly will never be seen, then potentially splurge it with bot traffic, then you can afford to make that inventory cheap. Running a website isn't expensive, which is why the average campaign is apparently now running on 44,000 of the things. I lean towards the viewpoint that they're environmentally toxic cesspits of unnessecary arbitrage that do nothing other than devalue the very concept of advertising. That's my kind of fence-sitting viewpoint on that. But I would say that, the existence of them isn't at all the fault of any one particular part of the industry, which is why there's probably been an inertia in removing them. But I think now, in terms of the market conditions where we're at, we're in the right place to be able to look at MFAs and basically force them out of the advertising chain. You've got a new focus on attention. You're focusing more on sustainability, more towards driving sales conversions, for example, through, you know, the likes of retail media. And I think hopefully that will provide, you know, that bit more drive to for those conversations to take place and go, actually, they're not providing value in the advertising chain. Let's move them out of media buys and focus more towards more premium sources of inventory.
James, tell me you disagree strongly.
I will similarly fence it and say that they absolutely shouldn't exist. And they aren't. They provide nothing other than the threat to premium publishers. You know, they are taking ad dollars away from content which is of value to the user, of value to the world. And you know, it's funding those businesses rather than that content. And I think it's a real shame. I would agree. You know, I think I've heard a fair bit, and on the panel I did at ATS a little while ago, there was some thoughts that, you know, really this sits with agencies and advertisers to solve. I mean, obviously it does, you know, it's their media dollars that are flowing to those sites. But I would also say, as premium publishers, we've been slow to act to deliver the outcomes that advertisers want. And we've been slow to do it at a price point that's affordable, you know, performance that works. So, you know, we need to up our game as well and be able to provide those things. And at the same time, I think measurement and attribution and value needs to be measured differently and with metrics that are based on real business outcomes. And attention could be one of those things. I worry a lot about attention. I worry that it's algorithm based for the most part, and it'll actually be very easy to game in the same way these sites do viewability.
That's interesting, because we kind of see the battle for attention has never been fiercer, really. It's almost like a whole new category for ad tech that just increases in importance the closer we get to cookie deprecation day, you know. I'm quite, my attention's piqued by your kind of reservation around it, because, you know, people believe that attention measures the kind of the true engagement, and, you know, got its effects for like sustainability and efficiency and improving monetization for both the buyers and sellers. Are you disagreeing with that then? Or have I misunderstood you?
I don't think I'm disagreeing with it. I think attention in theory is great. You know, that is the actual thing on a website that we want to measure to prove the value of the ad. But I just worry that the solutions that I've seen so far, they're not bad solutions in themselves, but because they're not measuring the actual attention of every user, they are things that in time will be gamed in the same way that the other metrics are.
Yeah, that's fair enough. Because I suppose there's a question about how do you effectively capture people's attention, right? And then what are the right technologies that are out there, and how do you kind of quantify it? Because God knows, do we need another nonsense metric in our lives? I don't think we do.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's a bit...
Yeah.
It's tricky. It's definitely a conversation to be had in more detail, I think. But I'm curious to understand then really what your thoughts are when it comes to, you know, what can the industry do to guarantee value for advertisers and marketers then, taking that into consideration. What are your thoughts around that? Or have you got any ideas of what we could be doing better?
So immediate, we're betting on, I guess, two things, really. One is that the publisher can provide some value and measurement, so that we can ask our users what they thought of advertising, what they think of brands, how their perception of that brand has changed. You know, we have that relationship with our users. We have a 20,000 panel, strong panel here that we can ask those questions to. We can ask them on the website. They'll answer them because they trust us and are engaged with the website. And I think that instead of measuring, you know, being a kind of arithmetic measurement, is just literally asking people, which is old fashioned, but is, I think, you know, as cookie deprecation really bites, I think something that perhaps we moved away from too quickly as an industry.
Okay. Matt, from the various, you know, as research leader at Exchange, where you've got your head buried in various conversations with large panels and advertisers and marketers directly, do you have any thoughts in terms of, you know, what the industry can do to kind of guarantee more value around this?
I think cross-industry dialogue and education are key here. And I think obviously brands need to be talking with their agency partners or setting up controls with their tech providers to ensure that their campaigns aren't being run on these sites where they're essentially whizzing money down the drain. And on the flip side, agencies can talk with you know, their marketer partners on the effect of running ads on these sites. Because obviously if you're head down trying to get, you know, either performance or your branding campaign out, you're not necessarily going to be thinking about the intricacies of, oh, this, what's this website that the site is running on? So yeah, that's where the dialogue comes in. And also on the same time, the, you know, tech providers, they have a very large role in highlighting the danger of buying from these sites, or the lack of value at the very least. And they can automatically set up, you know, conversations around blocking them from those media buys. Obviously, we've had a lot of attention with, you know, within the ad tech space on sustainability, and a lot of companies are doing a lot now to reduce carbon emissions around their part of the supply chain. Eventually, we're going to get to a point, hopefully, where MFAs, they're not going to be workable within a media buy because of how much carbon emissions it will add to it.
Yeah, I mean, I was pretty shocked, actually. We work with Scope 3 to sort of help to reduce our own carbon impact. And I mean, I've seen sort of MFA sites that use seven or eight times as much carbon as we do in their ad stack, because it's so complicated and involves so many calls to multiple calls to resellers, bid jamming, bid spamming, all sorts of stuff. And I worry those tactics are kind of leaking out into more traditional publishing as well in order to compete. You know, it's kind of algorithmic bidders that look to enhance bid requests and resell are becoming quite effective, to be honest. And, you know, rather than having that direct connection with SSPs, I don't think that, you know, we definitely don't want to move in that direction. That, you know, it's not sustainable.
Yeah, it's quite scary, isn't it? So it's open dialogue, better best practice, and just try and get rid of them as quickly as possible.
Essentially.
Fair enough. Talking about getting rid of things or adopting things, I'm going to move us on to the third story today, which is from the FT. And it's, I struggle because I don't know, X, otherwise known as, formerly known as Twitter, ex-chief Linda Yaccarino revives client counsel in effort to woo advertisers. That's the title of the article that we're referring to. And X, otherwise known as Twitter, I really just can't get to terms with this. Anyway, Linda Yaccarino is back on the charm offensive in the latest attempt to rebuild brand relationships with the platform. Air quotes here, excited to continue momentum in our business, and we are officially bringing back the client council in the fall. She tweeted, or she X'd, what do you say? I don't know. She tweeted, okay? It's nonsense. So that was on Thursday, right? Client councils have traditionally helped bring advertising dollars, providing exclusives and canvassing the opinion of top advertisers around platform changes and innovations. That's where they see success, okay? The platform has not determined who will be in the revived network. Having said that, Yaccarino, in her first live television interview since taking the helm at the company, whatever it's called, in May, she told CNBC that some brands, including Coca-Cola and Visa, had returned to the platform. That's exciting, you know, they're big brands, lots of influence. But I'm curious to know your thoughts around whether or not X or Twitter can rebuild its standing amongst advertisers in light of everything that's been happening in recent months. What are your thoughts around that, please?
Well, I should say I'm no expert on social media things. I've never X'd in my life.
Maybe it's a cross. I don't know. Maybe it's a kiss. Yeah. It's one massive kiss to everyone.
Yeah, that's right. It's such a friendly platform. It's just full of kisses. So it's not, and I don't want to slate Elon Musk because I worried he'll challenge me to a cage fight, and he's quite a big lad, so he'd probably win. But it's an interesting one, isn't it? I mean, I think it's a very, I think it must, you know, given the amount of problems that we have with brand safety on our websites, which include the, you know, hate speech filled Gardener's World and and sexual content stuff.
Explain that to our international listeners.
Gardener's World is a website largely about gardening,
but the hate speech that goes with it is terrible.
It really is. No, we do suffer from these problems. We see 20-30% of our inventory being stopped by brand safety tools. So wow. I can only imagine that the stuff you see on Twitter must be a very hard sell to the likes of Coca-Cola and Visa if they're blocking advertising on Radio Times. But you know, you can't. I think as a marketer, yeah, putting myself in their shoes, you can't really ignore the scale and the traction and the engagement that they have with users. So, you know, I'm not sure. I know a lot of brands, you know, I imagine will be tempted back, which I think is a bit of a shame given the level of discourse on the platform at the moment. I'm led to believe, not that I'm a regular visitor, but
who is these days? To be fair, though, and do you think I'm going to come to you in a second, Matt? So you know, get your thoughts ready. Do you think Linda can help advertisers see beyond Elon Musk, for example? She's got, you know, a tough job on her hands, really, hasn't she?
I think perhaps looking at the future of the app, building the Everything app, is probably better suited to Elon Musk's undoubted talents. But I think he just is such a polarizing figure. I worry he won't be content with his role in the background.
Yeah, that's a fair point. Matt, what do you think?
So I think, you know, back to my earlier point about dialogue, I think restoring that dialogue with advertisers is definitely the right move. Obviously, X burned a lot of bridges in the early days of the Musk era by axing the previous council in a huff when he opened the Pandora's box of loose content moderation. And then obviously any press inquiries for clarification on that were met with an auto response of a poo emoji. And I do think it's impressive that Iaccarino has managed to coax the likes of Mondelez. They've come back to the council. But whether it'll actually have much of an impact when Musk can seemingly do whatever the hell he wants with the platform, you know, I doubt the rebranding of X was meant to go as quickly as possible if you were coming from Iaccarino's standpoint. And there was a Washington Post story on Tuesday that Twitter was seemingly slowing access exclusively to sites criticised by Musk, such as the New York Times, Substack, Instagram and Facebook and Blue Sky, which doesn't really paint the picture of a reassuring steady hand at the corporate till look. And obviously to James's point about brand safety, there was a headline from yesterday in a report by Media Matters, which, you know, it says it all. X is placing ads for major brands on a verified pro-Hitler account. So that kind of shows how much of a, you know, speaking of toxic cesspits, just shows how much, you know, it's gone downhill in that regard. And again, to James's point on that scale, yes, I think traditionally in the past we have seen advertisers being very forgiving to platforms with poor brand safety. I know YouTube in the past has obviously had a lot of issues in the past. They put controls in to stop that. But I do question how legitimate X's scale now is. In, you know, when he was going over for the takeover, it apparently had, I think, 239 million monetizable daily active users, 65 million of which were supposed to be bots. And in July this year, so a year later, Musk is now claiming they have 542 million users. And I don't see how the number of users can apparently triple outside of a US election cycle just because there's a bit of a shit show with Musk tweeting his dismay at corporate takeovers. So yeah, I think there are questions that need to be had about how many users Twitter actually has.
I'd like to move away from toxic cesspits and I'd like to look and come to you, James, and hopefully you'll take us into a happier place and tell us what you're up to in the world of premium publishing and what, you know, on a day-to-day basis, what you're focused on and what's going on in immediate, please.
Yeah, sure thing. So, it's a relatively interesting time to be working in premium publishing, I think. And lots of challenges, but I think lots of really exciting opportunities. We're kind of talking about this a bit at ATS. I'm personally really interested in the sustainability stuff that seems to have become really popular over the last few months. I've been working on that for a year or so. I think, you know, I just think it brings the focus back to to content and premium publishing and away from kind of technology layers and middlemen, which is great for us. And also, you know, and absolutely essential for the planet. I was talking to, we had Scope 3 and actually yesterday doing some training for the sales teams. And I think that, you know, they were saying that the internet, the digital advertising industry is about the same as aviation in terms of its carbon impact, which is absolutely, I mean, it's absolutely shocking.
That is frightening, but I'm curious to know how they think the sales team are going to make a difference. I'm being a bit facetious, but I'm, yeah, please tell us more.
Yeah, I mean, I'm, you know, the way we're thinking about it is one of, you know, we have to, it's somewhat self-interestedly, you know, we would prefer, as always, as ever really, for brands to be spending with us directly. And obviously that is the most carbon efficient method of digital advertising. You know, it's 90%+ better than using open programmatic channels. And at the same time, you know, we're really focusing on cleaning up our own act and our programmatic supply chain. So we've started a bunch of work to, you know, just absolutely, you know, really minimize the number of vendors that we're working with, try to be smarter about the bid requests that we're sending out and not sending out, you know, just being much more dynamic, you know, not trying to force a massive ad tech stack down a 3G connection to someone standing at a train station, because obviously that will never result in an ad.
Should try and serve ads to me on Vodafone in St. Albans. Doesn't work. Nothing. I can barely make a phone call.
Yeah, I recently transferred to 5G on my phone, which means I just have a terrible signal everywhere, which is good. So that's really exciting, I think. And we're also really thinking hard about what we do with our consentless traffic, which I think is a really knotty problem for publishers and the industry generally, actually. Mm. You know, the ICO stuff that's been in the news recently.
Yep.
You know, we're going to have to put reject all on the first layer, as we absolutely should, really, you know, just from a consumer standpoint. But that is going to have a significant impact on our revenues. You know, we will lose the ability to monetize 20% of our audience as we're set up at the moment.
But that's going to be short term, right? You know, you'll find ways around to improve that, that experience will improve, and hopefully what you'll be able to charge will increase and you'll make up that revenue.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, obviously there'll be a scarcity value to then consented inventory, which will offset some of that. But obviously with the scale of inventory available on these kind of MFA sites and stuff, you know, how much of a bounce will we actually see in our CPM is a bit of an unknown. I think, we're really looking for tools to monetize that consentless traffic. At the moment, they're pretty underwhelming, to be honest.
You know, really?
The tracking that they offer, you know, is extremely basic, and the capabilities to do targeting are, again, extremely basic. You know, I mean, looking at one of the ad servers that we work with, you know, we can't even track clicks.
Wow. And are you seeing any differentiation between, are they coming to you kind of going, oh, we could do this in desktop, we could do this in mobile, or are they just all very basic?
It's just basically, we really can't do anything with this. And I can totally understand why, you know, with the regulatory pressure that these platforms are under, you know, they don't want to touch it with a barge pole. You know, it's just a court case waiting to happen. So, you know, they're really reticent, as they should be. You know, we want to be really, really careful with users' data. We want to make sure that we're respecting their choice not to have their activity tracked. But I think we need to work with regulators, work with the industry to find a better compromise for publishers.
I do hope there's something coming down the road. We're quite bullish about it. We're kind of coining it as PCT, post-cookie tech. And I think we're hoping that we'll see some real innovation coming through in the next 3 to 6 months. Because there's obviously a need, right?
Yeah, I mean, certainly for publishers like us, it kind of plays to our strengths in a way, you know, because we've got this great rich contextual information that's, you know, that we can use, but it's just, how do we connect it to the pipes?
Yeah.
Compliant way.
Yeah, that's the challenge, right? That's the stuff that kind of keeps you awake at night. So I'm sure there'll be plenty of people knocking on your door, sending emails after they listen to this, going, we've got the solution. Don't worry, James. We've got it. And you're probably going, okay. Well, that sounds like it's keeping you busy then.
Yeah, no, it's certainly not boring. I mean, at the same time, we also decided last year to completely re-architect our ad stack, which is obviously a great project.
How's that going?
In any way tricky.
So one year in, many more sleepless nights, Any kind of tips that you could share with our listeners, for your peers out there, to save them losing, turning grey, or, you know, their hair falling out?
Yeah, don't. No, don't do it. It's actually been really interesting. I mean, and I say really interesting in a way that, you know, it's not actually interesting for any normal people, but it is interesting for me. You know, we've gained a fair bit of ad speed just by cutting out all of the fat. We've looked at a really interesting implementation of pre-bid called PPI, which I don't think many people are using at the moment, but it basically makes them bid in parallel with GAM loading so that you're not waiting around.
Interesting.
Cool. So that's a good one. And just, you know, really trying to be smart about how we manage consent throughout the platform and doing it really quickly and kind of, you know, getting that information into the pipes as fast as we can. It's been cool. And just having a platform that's not cobbled together over a decade is really exciting. You know, it's a really modern stack that we actually, you know, we really kind of can work on without too much risk.
Brilliant. I'm gonna leave us there on that note, because we're pretty much running out of time, but that's a nice positive way to finish the conversation, I think. So it just leaves me to thank you, James, and thank you, Matt. And listeners, that's it for this week's podcast. Thank you very much.